Portions of today's program are mechanically reproduced. And now keep your dial set on Channel 26 for the finest of television programming.
There is nothing wrong with your television set. Do not attempt to adjust the picture. We are controlling transmission.
Relief. You two take care of labor.
Only intended for a plane, Captain.
Danger! Danger! Man your stations! Vehicle in direct path of meteor storm!
You don't want to die of cold. Toll free.
Look, I'm a doctor, not an escalator. Spock, give me a hand.
I'll give you trouble!
Pop your piece around the track if you get...
Two astronauts hurtled through a time warp return to Earth.
The year 3085.
Oh, my God.
We can't go home, Alan.
We're there already.
They are a threat.
Roddy McDowell, Ron Harper, James Naughton.
They must be found and quickly.
Planet of the Apes.
I'm David Klenk.
And I'm Troy Harkin.
Welcome back to Two Old Farts Talk Sci-Fi. Today we're excited to continue our all-TV season as we examine the mid-1970s Planet of the Apes boob tube offerings.
And David, this is our first episode recorded and released in the year 2025. Which to my eyes and ears feels like a date from the Planet of the Apes. I mean, once we passed 2001, a year that was for decades synonymous with sci-fi and the future, it all felt a little surreal, and it kind of still does. So anyway, welcome listeners to the future and the year 2025. And David, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, Troy.
Well, thanks very much. I feel like we need to give a little bit of a disclaimer as we kick off this episode. Predominantly, we'll be discussing the live-action series Planet of the Apes. And all of the shows we've covered, there may be no greater disparity between how much I loved a show and how good it actually was than what we're about to do with Planet of the Apes. Considering how short-lived the series was, it seems like it made a disproportionate impact on children of our generation.
Certainly a part of that impact was the merchandising blitz that 20th Century Fox already had in place for its... we can't keep saying Planet of the Apes, so we're going to use POTA as our short form for it.
Sounds good.
So 20th Century Fox already had a lot of merchandising in its, already in place for its POTA film series that immediately preceded the TV series. There were series-specific bubblegum cards, and we all loved bubblegum cards back in the day. They made them for almost everything. Yeah. And of course, the Mego action figures.
Yep, and there was the Marvel Planet of the Apes magazines. And they did a great job hyping the series while it was on. And when you came up for your rewatch with me, I pulled out some of those. And man, I still love those Planet of the Apes magazines.
Mm. So let's get into some of the history that led to the live action Planet of the Apes series. For those who may somehow be unaware, and I'm not sure if there's anyone out there that is unaware, 20th Century Fox produced a groundbreaking five-film series based on Pierre Boulle's novel, The Planet of the Apes. The films were the biggest science fiction film franchise prior to Star Wars. And like Star Wars, POTA was a success beyond the box office with merchandise tie-ins and unprecedented cultural reach and parodies.
Yep. So Unsurprisingly, even before the conclusion of the five-film POTA arc that ran from 68 to 73, 20th Century Fox and Planet of the Apes producer Arthur P. Jacobs had discussed the idea of bringing Planet of the Apes to television. Sadly, Jacobs died shortly after the release of Battle for the Planet of the Apes, and so clearly before the show had gone to air. Now, Twilight Zone creator Rod Serling had written two scripts that actually sort of acted as a two-part pilot, but those were not used, although they're very similar to what we did end up with.
The TV series was produced by Herbert Hirschman for CBS. So Hirschman had previously produced Playhouse 90 and Twilight Zone Season 4 for CBS. The show reportedly cost $250,000 per episode. And the question is, where did they put the other $245,000? No, just kidding, partly. But
that's your Blair Witch, yeah, that witch joke. You've just repurposed it.
Yes. Yeah. Which was Chris Rock, I think, did that famously, where he said it was $50,000. What did they do with the other $45,000? But anyways, so the Planet of the Apes series premiered on Friday, September 13th, 1974 at 8 p.m. on CBS. It was the same time slot as NBC's hugely successful sitcoms Sanford and Son and Chico and the Man. POTA debuted in 43rd place.
Now, it's funny because I'd heard that stat about 43rd place. So that's got to mean, I guess, for the season in terms of debuts that season, because you know there were only three networks at that point, so how could you end up in 43rd among, you know, three networks? But so I guess it must be 43rd for the year of new premieres, I'm guessing.
Yeah,
so if anybody knows something contrary to that, let us know. So 14 episodes were produced for the series. It went off the air in December of 74. And I mean, that's Christmas. So I must have been a very sad little Troy that Christmas, like tuning in, looking for more POTA and coming up empty. The show was set in the year 3085. That's 900 years before Taylor arrives in the original film and 400 years after Battle for the Planet of the Apes. The promo for the Planet of the Apes in TV Guide read, "New show! Now it's the series! Roddy McDowall stars in his original role," which is wrong, because he does not come back as Cornelius. And it goes on to say, "As the simian ally in a strange world where apes rule and men are ruled." And every time I've read that, I keep thinking it's going to say "where apes rule and men drool," which would have been great graffiti to have in the background of the Planet of the Apes series. Just have that on a wall. Apes rule, humans drool. Let me now just, you know, we were tipped off by actually your brother-in-law, Robert J. Sawyer, who is a huge Planet of the Apes fan, to the website Hunter's Planet of the Apes Archives. And man, that thing is a treasure trove of apes information. So much archival, like scripts, as well as just things about the merchandising and the whole Go Apes promotion. Anyway, I'm holding in my hand the Planet of the Apes concept. So it's kind of like a mini version of what would become the Bible for Planet of the Apes. And so originally the astronauts were named Alan Verdon and Stan Kovac. So we lose the name Stan Kovac later. It says the series begins with the return of Kovac and Verdon to Earth, only to discover they have passed through a time warp and the Earth is no longer as they knew it, with multiple ellipses here, 1, 2, 3, 4, and I hate it when there's more than three. I'm sorry. Save the planet, people. Three dots. It has become the Planet of the Apes. And a little note about the leads. It says Alan Verdon is the more sensitive, more responsible astronaut with a family, yada yada. It says Stan Kovac, who would become Peter Burke, Stan Kovac, on the other hand, is much more of a man of the moment, no strings on him. He realizes that he must make new lives in this new world. Galen is a courageous chimpanzee who possesses some of the taboos and peculiar concepts of his civilian, or sorry, of his civilization and heritage, but he is open-minded and willing to learn from the astronauts. In the first episode, Galen and the astronauts become cautious friends, fellow fugitives, and other alliterative things, and begin to feel an almost brotherly allegiance. How about a brotherly bond? I would have went brotherly bond if you're going for the alliteration. And then it says the goal. Before the total destruction of their own spaceship, Verdon managed to rescue a magnetic disc containing all information fed by the circuitry of the ship's computers from the moment of takeoff to the instant of forced landing. They find the means of returning them to their own time period. It is this hope that causes Verdon to cling desperately to the magnetic disc and continue his journey from one place to another. And that's it, basically. I just wanted to give you a sense of the way it was originally envisioned and kind of what we do get, right? Well, as we'll see as we go through here. David, why don't you hit us up with the roll call of actors on the Planet of the Apes, the TV series?
Yeah, I think I can do that. The leads, Ron Harper, played Commander Alan Verdon. He also starred in Garrison's Guerrillas and would later star in the third season of Land of the Lost. Harper passed away on March 21st of 2024. James Naughton played astronaut Peter Burke. He previously starred in The Paper Chase alongside Lindsay Wagner. James Naughton would also go on to win two Tony Awards for the productions City of Angels and Chicago. James Naughton is also the older brother of actor David Naughton, who starred in An American Werewolf in London and his famous late 70s Dr. Pepper ads.
There's winning, Pepper's spinning, Pepper's none, Pepper's fun, Pepper's...
Wouldn't you like to be a Pepper too? Be a Pepper, drink Dr. Pepper, be a Pepper.
David Naughton's first acting role was in the POTA episode, The Surgeon, as Dr. Stoll.
That's kind of cool.
Roddy McDowell. Oh, yeah, yeah. It's amazing the connection there. The Naughtons certainly were a class of actors, for sure.
They're POTA people.
Roddy McDowell. POTA, yes, POTA actors,
yeah.
Assemble. No, I don't know. Roddy McDowell played Galen. McDowell had a remarkable career appearing in feature films like Lassie Come Home, Camelot, and let's not confuse those two, by the way, just anyways. that sounds like a great double bill there.
Yeah.
The Longest Day, The Legend of Hell House is one of my favorites. I'm just worried that if I watch it again, it may not hold up. The Poseidon Adventure. On TV, he appeared in The Twilight Zone, Night Gallery, Buck Rogers, Mork and Mindy.
The dude did it all.
Well, it was just one of my favorite actors of the time. So wonderful. But it's been suggested that McDowell signed on to the show for $350,000. Which was a pretty good money back in the mid-70s, I would think. It has also been written that McDowell approached 20th Century Fox while casting was underway for the series leads. Because it took so long to apply the makeup for his chimpanzee character, Galen, Roddy's production days ran from 4 a.m. to 4 p.m. We lost a legendary actor on October 3rd, 1998, to lung cancer.
Yeah, that must have been quite a thing, you know, when if you were a part of the TV series, and I guess the films as well, but if you were the apes, the people playing the apes, you would have all of that makeup to do, all that time in the chair before you even started shooting. So I can imagine there being almost like some animosity between the ape actors and the human actors. Like, you already get a bit of a divide. And I do know that during the movie shooting for the first two films, Kim Hunter had said that it was weird when they had lunch breaks that the apes would You know, it would be a tribal thing. The ape actors would eat among themselves and the human actors would eat somewhere else. And the rest of the crew too would eat, like all the humans would eat together and all of the apes would eat on their own.
Yeah, and it may have even been more subdivided because you may have had the people dressed as the chimpanzees dressed differently than the gorillas that sit at different tables
than
the gorillas and so on. And it just happened that that's what it was, an unusual thing. I think it was something that my brother-in-law mentioned to me. You're right, at the interview with Kim Hunter, for sure. Getting back to the cast, Booth Coleman played the TV version, Dr. Zaius. Coleman was a veteran actor. Veteran character actor who appeared in many classic TV shows, including Gunsmoke, Bonanza, The Outer Limits, Thriller, Kung Fu, The Wild Wild West, and many others. Mark Leonard played the guerrilla villain, General Urko. He was also Spock's father, Sarek, on the Star Trek The Next Generation, as well as some of the Trek feature films. I also remember him as the Romulan commander in Balance of Terror. Mark Leonard also appeared on Mission Impossible, The Incredible Hulk, and Hawaii Five-O.
Well, it's kind of cool that he was on Mission Impossible as well as Leonard Nimoy.
Yes, and Leonard Nimoy is also someone that had to go through the makeup stuff because he would have to show up a bit early to get the get the green face paint and the ears, and
eyebrows
and so on. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I will say that of the potential problems the Planet of the Apes TV series faced, the performances by the lead actors were not one of them. We might get into it later. I don't know, but when we were doing our rewatch, I was really impressed by Galen. I think, and of course, Roddy McDowall, but I think as a kid, I didn't even, you just went, oh, that's Galen the ape. You know, this is not Roddy McDowall. This is Galen. I believe it. Like his facial features, the way he would twitch and whatnot. Oh my God, so good.
Yeah.
Okay, David, let's dig into some of our notes on the Planet of the Apes TV series. So like Battle for the Planet of the Apes, the humans in the TV series are not yet mute, which makes sense because it's earlier. You know, we're still a few hundred years away from the Charlton Heston Taylor arrival. It'd be hard to drive a series without talking humans, although I think a nice touch would have been if humans were forbidden to talk to other humans, or they're forbidden to speak unless spoken to by apes. Or maybe they're only allowed to speak in pig Latin.
You're weighing hay, the anime. You're weighing hay, the anime. E way out, gay way up, way out, way in, way extinct, gay on well.
Which maybe is a bridge too far there, but I'd still like to hear that.
Or maybe a nice Cockney accent.
That's
and
right.
Then someone could say, by George, I think he's got it.
You're right, Gov. Yeah.
Oh, no.
Morning, Governor. Yeah. That'd
all
be
right.
Great.
That would be great and awful at the same time.
Yeah.
So as in the original POTUS series, the space agency is called ANSA, A-N-S-A, not NASA, N-A-S-A.
Yeah. Although I will say, because it's in my mind right now, so I'm going to say it now because God knows things don't stay in my mind that long. I realized today that the animated series on the side of the capsule, I don't know if they're reusing footage or if it just slipped their mind, but the capsule in the animated series says NASA.
That's right.
Not ANSA, which is weird.
Yep.
Let's talk a little bit about Jones, the other astronaut, the dead one. As in all or most POTA projects, one astronaut must not survive the voyage. The death count includes Stewart from the original film, Skipper, not Skipper from Gilligan's Island, but Skipper from Beneath the Planet of the Apes, Dr. Milo, who does initially survive the journey with Cornelius and Zira back to 1973, but then he's offed by a modern-day gorilla. And here in the POTA TV series, it's Jonesy, who kicks the bucket. A moment of silence for Jonesy, please. And it does crack me up, though, that, you know, we don't get any other name. I thought it'd be funny if they actually showed his name. Like, I think in the original movie, the astronauts have their surnames on their outfits, right?
Right.
And but it'd be funny if it just said Jonesy, not Jones, but Jonesy. That's his actual God-given name or whatever. God-given. That's not what I mean to say.
Yeah, and watching it again, you got the three astronauts there, one of whom is dead. And I was trying to figure out, how exactly did the astronaut die first? And secondly, if this was that long a journey, why weren't they doing something similar and having those chambers where you actually have the long sleep? I didn't quite understand that. But
not explained. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. There's some differences and some... but you would expect that, right? Yeah. So one of the things that we noted during our rewatch was the lack of a female lead or a love interest in the film series. In the original novel, we had Zira and Nova. And once they were both gone, we had Lisa, the spouse of Caesar.
Yep, yep. I'm really surprised that TV being what it was in the 1970s, that the POTA series missed that opportunity for a female sex symbol or a strong female lead. Imagine guest spots by actresses of the time, like Peggy Lipton, Julie Newmar, Heather Thomas would have been a little later, but even Cheryl Ladd, who was on Charlie's Angel.
Yeah,
Angels.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's right. It does miss something. It misses a dynamic and it misses that energy and the whole relationship thing. It just seems more like a buddy kind of show, you know, like a Starsky and Hutch kind of thing. I mean, and in some cases, some of the men on those shows, like in the A-Team, I remember reading something about how they resented the woman that was sort of the reporter just because they felt this is just a guy vehicle, so to speak.
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe, you know, part of me thought, well, are they aiming it at kids and that's why? But then if you do that, you're also limiting yourself to boys predominantly. You know, if you throw in a female character, obviously you're going to have like girls invested in it too. But the odd thing, something that I guess maybe if we were comparing, oh my God, David, where's my brain today? Comparing, the two TV ape shows, the live action one and the animated one. Mm. The one thing, one of the few things the animated show perhaps gets better than the live action one is that they had Zira and they had Nova and they had a female astronaut. So, you know, maybe that's, you know, points to them in that category.
Oh, absolutely. Because it's series is episodic rather than a serial. Every episode starts and ends the same way, with, you know, them being pursued by one-armed man. Oh, sorry, that's another series. Sorry about that. But it does have that sense that you're going from village to village and town to town, meeting new characters. It's almost that same story that's been replayed on so many TV series through time. Every episode starts and ends the same way with Galen and the two astronauts on the run. It's like Sisyphus or Groundhog Day. You're left with a sense of, hey, haven't I seen this before?
Boom! He's on his back! You'll feel that one tomorrow.
Maddeningly. I can't even say that word.
Yeah, that's where my brain and tongue is. Maddeningly!
Amazing! That is concentration.
Maddeningly.
Yeah, I used to love playing Maddeningly 94. I like the old school Maddens. Yeah.
Yes.
What a hit!
And yes, basically, I think I've completely lost it now. Whatever it is, we've caught it. So Maddeningly. Okay, this is going to end up on the blooper reel at the end of the season, I think.
It's frustrating. It's frustrating. Frustratingly. Yeah.
And frustratingly, there are a few examples which are maddening where a through line between shows does exist, but the network ended up not showing the episodes in the order it was intended. So that got butzed up. And we know that from Firefly. And there's been a number of series that I just don't understand, Troy, why the network would muck around with that when there's a whole point in the order that they're supposed to be shown. I don't get it.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense if you're shooting it maybe out of order for some reason, and then you set the continuity straight in the presentation order. But yeah, it's weird. It's like, I feel like network TV was shooting itself in the foot, like so often. You know, the more we do these episodes, the more it seems like, well, you kind of screwed yourself on that one. Screwed the pooch, as they say. Anyway, yeah. And when you and I, it just so happened that we watched out of order, so it's kind of funny too. But there were two episodes that we watched where they go into, you know, the dilapidated city. And like the first time was fine, but the second time, clearly it was done without any consideration for the previous time going into the destroyed city, because they say like, oh, a city, I haven't been in a city, you know, forever. It's like, no, you kind of were there 2 weeks ago, you know. It's like, and it's the exact same like location they're using too, which I found even funnier.
I didn't just find it funny, Troy. I found it maddening.
Yeah, yeah. As a 9-year-old kid, this show for me was right up there with the $6 Million Man, and to me, the opening was almost as intense as the $6 Million Man. Lalo Schifrin, he did the theme. It was strange and hair-raising, and maddeningly, I couldn't get enough of it. I'm going to keep saying maddeningly now. It actually kind of reminded me of the really weird Night Gallery thing, which I still think is one of the weirdest pieces of music ever used for network TV. If I just heard that as a kid, it would freak me out. It would give me the heebie-jeebies.
I love those heebie-jeebies.
Yeah.
Like most of the shows we've covered this season, the POTUS series had many merchandise tie-ins, including the great Mego 8-inch action figures and playsets. It actually amazes me how much Mego stuff was created despite how short-lived the series was.
Yeah.
Think of it. The show began right after Labor Day as a new school year was starting, and then bang, it's gone before Christmas vacation began. 14 episodes, yet they still have all these commercial tie-ins.
Yeah, and it went on for ages. They kept putting out like new play sets for the show. Now, originally Mego had produced a POTA movie line. So it had like Cornelius Zira, Ursus, Zaius. And for whatever reason, they didn't have the rights. Maybe it was the rights to the likeness of Charlton Heston, because that was also true of the comic books. And in the bubblegum cards, they could only use a limited number of images of Charlton Heston as well. So they didn't even call him Taylor. They just called him the astronaut in the original release of those, the first release of Mego figures. And but when the TV series came out, they did a whole new line with Galen, Verdon, Burke, Urko. And I don't know if they did another Zaius or if you were just supposed to like repurpose your original Zaius. But the cool thing was you could, as a kid, you would play with, like, you would introduce Zira to this. So like, even if the TV series didn't give you a female character, now you could integrate the original POTA film characters with the TV line. And their play sets that they kept introducing were really pretty cool. Like they had really neat things. Like they had a Forbidden Zone set. They had an ape treehouse thing. They had a lot of diorama. Yeah,
kind.
Yeah. And there was also in, I forget which episode it was, but we watched it. The one where the ape's up on a station and he's got a reflective, looks like a conch or something or a shell. And they're doing like a, not semaphore, but they're doing a, what do you call it, Dave, there? The dot, dash.
Yeah,
dot,
it's almost
dash.
Like Morse code almost.
Yeah, right. They're doing that type of thing with a reflective shell. Anyway, that was released as a play set as well. Anyway, I love that stuff. I have a couple of recasts. I have like sort of over my shoulder, I do have a Dr. Zaius, and I would love to, in my geekdom, find some of the original figures as well. You know, one of the good things about the series was that it looked great, and it struck me watching like DVD versions of these shows that, you know, don't always stand up that great on modern monitors, and the makeup still looks fabulous despite the fact that no one dreamed we'd be watching the show 50 years later in high resolution on these, you know, massive monitors. And we talked a little bit about Roddy McDowall and just how fantastic
apparently
he was.
It doesn't matter to you that your mother worries.
Of course it matters.
Then why aren't you at home instead of running around the country like a hunted yeoman?
It's not my fault that I'm hunted. My friends are willing to live in peace, so am I.
You are an ape. Your friends are humans. Strange friends for a chimpanzee.
Not if you know them. Well, you'd respect them too if it weren't for your stupid prejudices.
I am older than you. Perhaps those so-called stupid prejudices are based on reason.
No, they are not. They are based on custom and on habit, and you know it.
Even if I agreed with you, and I don't, do you think you can change the whole world?
I'd like to.
Even when the scripts are not that great, he never mails it in. At all times, he's performing, giving those great close-up reaction shots, twitching his nose and furrowing his brows, and acting with his eyes and inflection. And man, I don't know if he did mime work when he was younger, but the way he carries himself as Galen, you forget that you aren't watching an actual talking ape. Roddy has stated that of the three ape characters he played, Cornelius, Caesar, and Galen, that Galen from the TV series was his favorite. You got any thoughts on Mr. McDowell or some of those performances, Dave?
Yeah. And it would be a surprise to most people when, if he was to pick those three characters, he'd pick Galen. He gives a lot of opportunities, there's a lot that he could do with that character in the TV series. For me, it would have been Cornelius, and maybe Caesar second and Galen third. But maybe he just was able to, with all the experience he had already done in the movies, be able to take even another different tact or different way, because he had all that experience behind him, and he put that all into the Galen character, so likable, so good, and just the interactions and how he acts just works perfectly. I'm wondering if some of the people like an Andy Serkis and others who do this kind of thing may have seen Roddy McDowell, his portrayals in the movies and the series, as reasons why they wanted to do that kind of work.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you mentioned Andy Serkis, Dave, because, you know, I was thinking that if anybody is worthy of a special Oscar for performance, Roddy McDowell might have been one of those for his eight performances, because I don't assume that anybody can just like put the makeup on and become the character of one of these apes. And there's nuance to all of his characters that he does. I was thinking of, as you were talking about in Escape, he does such a great job in Escape from the Planet of the Apes, because that film requires comedic chops and like a pathos. There's so much, it's a tragic film. Like the end of that film, I find it moves me more than even the end of Beneath, when you know the entire planet is being destroyed. But the way he performs as Cornelius and he's losing his child and his wife, it's heartbreaking. He does such a great job. And then the next film is Caesar. He ratchets up the naivete of this young ape who doesn't, you know, he's being brought out into the world for the first time. You get a sense, like you believe that this is a young ape, a young, inexperienced ape. And then he goes through that arc of rebellion, the revolution that is Conquest of the Planet of the Apes. That's also a striking performance. But anyway, hats off to Roddy McDowell for all his performances. But in particular here, Galen, because we are talking about the series. Now, I heard somebody mention the comparison of Verdon to MacGyver, as well as the professor from Gilligan's Island, which I thought was a really funny and interesting observation.
Sack time, huh? Oh, let's check in here. I'm ready.
No way, baby. This is our chance to get clear. We know what direction we're going in. They don't.
There's nothing in any direction. What difference does it make?
You can tell direction by that. I mean, without the stars.
Yeah, it's called a compass, Galen. That needle always points north. And that cloud cover is a big break. Orko's men won't know what direction they're going in, so they'll go in circles. We can go straight on.
Compass? Is it witchcraft?
Witchcraft, no. It's handicraft. I made it.
Hey, next handicraft class, make me a trail bike, twin jet.
You got it. Come on.
Right, yeah, trying to build or do things with the technology that's around. You know, you can, and that was a weird thing with the professor from Gilligan's Island. He can do all of this stuff other than actually repair or make a boat or ship to be able to get them off the island. But, you know, if you need a stage play, or you need something else, you know, whatever it is, you know, he's got a couple of coconuts and some some other stuff that he can, that he can do whatever it is. So you're right. The MacGyver, of course, could. And I always love the parodies of MacGyver on, and they even made a movie of it.
Oh, SNL.
Saturday Night Live.
Yeah. MacGruber. Yes. MacGruber.
MacGruber.
Yeah.
But, through the series, Alan Verdon is often the white male savior of both the humans and the apes. He's always jerry-rigging something, like he's a 31st, as we were saying. He's like the 31st century MacGyver, which could have been the title of this series.
That's right. They should have called him McVerdon or something. Said, what'll we do, McVerdon? Yeah, I always wanted Pete Burke to say, if you're so damn smart, why don't you fix the ship and get us out of here? You know, like, just get us the hell out of here. Come on, Professor. The other TV comparison that I saw with our, you know, main trio of characters was Verdon, Burke, and Galen as Kirk, McCoy, and Spock. And that occurred to me as we were doing our rewatch, where you've got Verdon is the leader. He's like the Kirk. Burke is the wisecracking cynic like Bones. And Galen is the alien outsider like Spock. But I think there's, you know, other places you can go with that. But
well, Star Trek, everything comes back to either the Beatles or Star Trek. The Star Trek example, just how important and how brilliant was the idea of having the three leads, one being the captain, and you've got the emotional and the scientific. You've got the two almost like angels, or the angel and devil kind of thing. You've got the person who's gets so, but all together, when they work together as a unit of three people, when you've got the leader and you've got the emotional side and the scientific side all working in harmony to resolve something, that's a very powerful thing to have.
Yeah. Yeah. Now there's the one thing that anytime I've ever read anything about this series, heard anything about this series, it comes down to one thing, and it's the...
Yeah, we're heading into rough waters here.
Yep.
With
yep.
The whole... Yeah, so Troy, why don't you start to, and bring up the whole thing about the matter of the dog.
Okay, alrighty. So early on in the first episode, we see a dog with the famous actor Royal Dano. Well, some folks are disturbed because it is established in Escape and Conquest of the Planet of the Apes that cats and dogs are killed due to a virus brought back from space, and therefore there should be no dogs on the Planet of the Apes TV series. But I'm able to allow dogs via a few different possible explanations. So explanation one, animals did die off, but many years after the virus and before the total downfall of human civilization, cloned samples of cats and dogs were brought forward. Explanation two is that some dogs on isolated islands or other remote places were never exposed to the virus and survived. Explanation three, the existence of dogs in episode one of the Planet of the Apes series suggests that this is a different timeline or a different reality or a multiverse in which the extinction of house pets never happened. Do you have any thoughts on the inclusion of dogs in the Planet of the Apes series, Mr. Klink?
I would be much more accepting of it if Leonard Nimoy as Spock appeared with a beard, with a goatee, yeah, and started killing people. Like, if that happened with the whole Kelvin or this whole other thing, if that actually happened, I would be more accepting. But the whole idea of these dogs showing up, and I think that was twice. Like, a few of the episodes are different dogs.
Yeah.
And that was the first thing, was you hear this barking. Like, how do you open up a series based on the fact that pets, and if you take the version that says that it's a different timeline where the house pets didn't go extinct, then how that, then you have to have also an explanation of why apes became intelligent, or them taking over, because the whole right. concept of it was that we lost our cats and we lost our dogs, and we somehow decided to take chimps and other ape species to become our pets, or become the, you know, because we need that companion, we need that
right.
I mean, just imagine if it was Old Yeller was a chimpanzee, that would be
right.
a whole other.
Yeah,
that would, I don't know. I don't get it.
You know, you just reminded me of a discussion that could be had. There was a Marvel series. Now, during the period in the late 60s when Planet of the Apes was the bomb, I don't mean the Beneath Planet of the Apes bomb, but, you know, was the hot property. And everybody wanted something POTA. Marvel, before they had any rights to the series. Actually, sorry, it wasn't Marvel. It was DC. DC was like, we need some POTA material here. And Jack Kirby was with DC at that point, not Marvel. They said, we need something that's like POTA, but not POTA, so we don't get sued. So they came up with a series, a comic called Commandy, The Last Boy. And I quite like the series, but in it, there's like a similar cataclysmic explosion or war that causes the downfall of humans. And there is something, I don't remember what the factor is, that basically, rather than just apes, all animals gain the power of speech. And basically all of the animals take over the planet and humans are subjugated. It's a really cool series. And in fact, the very first cover has Commandee, the last boy, in a raft, and it looks like he's crossing the Hudson River or something. And in the background is the devastated New York City, as well as the Statue of Liberty sticking out of the Hudson at a like cockeyed angle. So not too dissimilar at all from the final moment. Spoiler of Planet of the Apes. But if you ever get a chance to pick up a Commandee graphic novel, David, I would recommend that you do that.
Well, tell you what, Troy, riddle me this. When is a POTA movie not a POTA movie?
Good question.
It is a good question. When the TV series is repackaged and presented as original films on TV, I couldn't believe this happened. I mean, we did discuss this on about Buck Rogers and also the Battlestar Galactica, where they took a couple episodes and brought them out as actual theatrical ones. No, these were actual TV films on TV. These films aired under the names Back to the Planet of the Apes, Forgotten City on the Planet of the Apes, Treachery and Greed on the Planet of the Apes, Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness on the Planet of the Apes, and Farewell to the Planet of the Apes. These pseudo-films were aired across ABC affiliates in the U.S. during the late 70s and 1980s.
And, you know, perhaps the only good thing to come out of these repackaged POTA Frankensteins were the Galen bumpers.
I didn't expect you so soon. Allow me to introduce myself. My name is Galen. Now, I'm so glad you could join me today. It is a marvelous story you're going to see. I remember it as if it was yesterday. Your spaceship shooting out of the heavens. Oh, what a shock it must have been to discover what the world had come to. What a shock it was for me, too. Heavens knows. But I'm getting ahead of myself. So let us go back and see what it was like. Back to the Planet of the Apes.
In 1981, when ABC aired the foam movies, they had Roddy McDowall reprise his role as Galen to do intros and outros for each of these films. He explained what became of Burke and Verdon, and here it is.
Verdon and Burke? Oh, well, they found their computer in another city and disappeared into space as suddenly as they'd arrived. What about me? I certainly could have gone with them. Back to your time, your world, where apes are kept in zoos. Tell me now, would you have come to my world willingly? You will, eventually. Of course. It's only a matter of time.
So, Troy, I was wondering if you can just let me know what you consider some of the best... I mean, there's only 14, and you could just say all 14 are the best episodes.
Yeah.
But sometimes there's one, you know, sometimes you get something that's like Darmok in the Next Generation. You get something that just stands out or is just, you wish that more episodes were like that one, of that quality or that different or making whatever statement or that emotional, whatever it is that brings you in like the inner light. So I was wondering if you can go over some of your... what you consider are the best episodes.
Well, there's some that, you know, are essential. And I figure it's not really a pilot, the Escape to Tomorrow, the first episode. And again, it's technically not a pilot because they were able to go on the strength of the existing series. So they didn't need to pitch it to anybody. It was signed by 20th Century Fox as we're doing this, you know, this is good to go, which kind of surprises me if that was the attitude that they still pulled the plug on it so quickly. Anyway, you know, the first episode gives us all of the things and establishes you know, who our main astronauts are, who Galen is. So, I mean, you can't skip that one. That's like sort of essential. The episode, The Trap, which came early on, I would have to put up there. It was episode 3. And in it, Burke and Urko are trapped in a subway station together following an earthquake. And they must work together before they die from the poisonous subterranean gas that's been released. And that's one that you and I saw. And the cool thing about it is that is a situation that we never really saw in the films at all. So it was kind of cool giving this this idea of united we stand, divided we fall, like having to work together. And of course, as soon as Urko gets back, he's ready to kill them again. And it struck me that Urko in the series is also reminds me of Elmer Fudd. Because, like, he is so driven to kill the two humans in the same way that Elmer Fudd wants to kill either Bugs Bunny or Donald Duck. He doesn't care. You know, it's like, it's always human season with Urko. It's like, okay, yeah, we worked together for a little bit, but now we're out, like, shoot him now. And which is, he's always at odds even with Zaius, right? Because Zaius is always... well, let's examine them. Let's learn more about them. Let's study them. And Urkel's like, screw that. Like, let's just kill them. It's like they're a wrinkle in everything for us. Like, let's just get rid of them. Anyway, so that was The Trap. And in The Legacy, that's the episode where the boys go back into the city and forget that they'd ever been there, apparently. But it also gives us that really cool moment of them finding a computer, and they get this little kind of hologram message, and then the computer goes on the fritz, so they're left like wanting more. But they're also told that there are other computers around that has other information. So this is what we want from the series. This is sort of, this should be the groundwork for the series, but they never follow through on it, really, or they quickly abandon the idea of like trying to find these other computers. But
well, that was Verdon, right? That grabbed the actual computer disk.
Yeah.
Or whatever it was. Thinking, MacGruber? Oh, there's
yes.
Gonna, yeah, there's going to be some kind of a computer or still around with the same format that you can actually read this disk. Right. Even though they're 500 to 1,000 years later, after leaving Earth or whatever.
Like, now here's the thing, like, right, like this is so funny, and it's something that like I loved about existing in the 1970s is that. So what did you listen to your music on? Your turntable, and turntables in different forms had existed for decades. You know, so it's like this is how we do it. If you wanted to phone somebody, phones essentially looked the same for ages, right? There was like some difference between push button and rotary. And prior to that, phones, you know, hung up on a wall, and the what you spoke into was separate from what you listened into.
Yeah.
But other than that, phones were essentially phones. So I guess the assumption was that computers, you know, would remain the same. Little did they know that we live in a world where you have to upgrade shit every like year, if not like sooner. And that if you don't have the proper, like, you know, like cord, like your cords, forget coaxial cable for your old TV. Cause like, we don't even do that now. You know, USB, who knows? Like, it's like things, we're a cordless society now. Things change so quickly. So you're right. Yeah, like, forget about technology from the 1980s existing into, like, two centuries.
Yeah, but Verdon was very smart, because what he realizes, he could just MacGyver something. No matter how many different things, no matter how maddeningly there is of different technologies, he would somehow MacGyver some shit together and make it so that he could. Maybe they remember time machine movie with those spinning rings that made all that sound. You could actually have the history of it. Like, oh, he does want to be able to play this, get the information from it. It does make some sense, but I just don't understand how he would be able to do that. But anyways.
Okay, you just made me realize. Okay, first of all, there was a period in, I guess it was the early 90s, where all of these remakes were made for film. But they tended to be ironic and smirky, right? Which kind of drove me nuts. Like, even I wanted it. Like, I would still love a gritty Starsky and Hutch remake. I don't really want like an Owen Wilson, Ben Stiller, you know, smirky version. I want like something that, you know, feels the way the series felt to me when I was watching it in the '70s. But having said that, I would love a wisecracking, ironic version of the Planet of the Apes TV series as a big screen film, because it would be great to have Verdon doing his MacGruber thing all the time, right? Where he's like, well, you know what, if we take this and we put this together, and then the people are just looking at him like, what the fuck are you thinking? And it's like, no, you can't do that because this technology doesn't even exist anymore. And then it's like, ugh. And then they go on to the next scenario where he pulls that shit again. And they're saying, no, that's not going to fly, dude. Sorry. That would crack me up, actually. Okay, where are we? I've got a couple more episodes to mention.
Yeah, you just did Legacy.
Yeah. And in the Legacy, they are in Oakland, which I found was interesting because the series tends to be an East Coast thing. And now we're doing like a West Coast version of POTA. So clearly there should be no opportunity to have any characters that ever knew each other from the original film series over on the West Coast. Like they're just not going to meet up, and that's not even taking into account like time differences and whatnot. But so this, our TV series, it's established, is on the West Coast. So two other episodes these are more like sort of like, I want to say honorable mentions. they're okay, but like they're not essentials. Although I guess if you're going to do just 13 or 14 episodes, like they're maybe all essential. I don't know. So let me tell you about The Surgeon. In it, Verdon is shot. Galen takes his friend to a former lover who is a surgeon named Kira, played by Jacqueline Scott. And that had some cool moments in it. And the nice thing was Verdon shut up for a while as a result of being unconscious. And we got to have a lot of Burke, which was, I was a Burke guy myself. I appreciated that. And also, speaking of being like Burke heavy episodes, there's an episode called The Deception where there's a blind ape girl, Fauna, played by Jane Ackman. And she falls in love with Burke. So I guess maybe I've just mentioned two episodes where there's like love interests, but it's still not like sort of what I was thinking of earlier when we were talking about the lack of female regular characters. And there's also this cool, okay, I don't want it. I almost made it sound like I was going to say the KKK are cool. No, kids, the KKK are not cool. They are the opposite of cool. But in the episode, there are these KKK like hooded gorillas hunting humans, and it was damn scary. And even the image of it is scary now. And it's weird because like you don't see their faces, so it's hard to know they're gorillas. But just the fact that they are hooded gorillas is a frightening thing. Anyway, those are the five that I would say you must see. We've mentioned it a little bit, but if we are talking Planet of the Apes on television in the mid-1970s, it is incumbent upon us to at least touch on the Planet of the Apes animated series, Return to the Planet of the Apes.
Return to the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, the animated series, Return to the Planet of the Apes consisted of 13 episodes that aired on NBC on Saturday mornings in 1975 from September 6th to November 29th. Star Trek had run a successful animated series that was produced by Filmation in the 73-74 season. Not only was the Trek cartoon well-received, it actually won Emmy Awards. It was hoped a POTA animated series could replicate that success. Unlike Star Trek, the animated Planet of the Apes did not see existing stars of the franchise returning to reprise their roles. POTA without Roddy McDowall is almost blasphemy. The Star Trek animated series also used existing scripts and story ideas for their show. Return to the Planet of the Apes did not have that luxury.
Yeah, in many ways, the animated series is the truest adaptation to the pure Boole novel because Ape Civilization is much more sophisticated than in the original five films and in the live-action TV series. Now, the cartoon features the de rigueur crash landing of astronauts on a, spoiler alert, Planet of Apes that is actually, spoiler alert, Earth in the future. The three astronauts, and you kind of pointed this out, well, we came to it together. The three astronauts kind of look like a mix of the Mod Squad meets Johnny Quest. And and you, like, you were all over that when I showed you the some of the videos. And it just came to me today, or I just learned, that producer Doug Wildey, who created Johnny Quest, did this series. So who is it again?
There's a character in Johnny Quest named Race Bannon, who is sort of the muscular, strong guy, with the, you know, for some reason, some people have yellow hair, in comics, which I don't quite understand that still. But when I saw him on the screen in the Planet of the Apes animated thing, I'd say, what is Race Bannon doing on the Planet of the Apes? That's really bad luck for him.
Yeah, that's not the kind of quest you
and
want
to get. Where's Haji and where's wherever that dog's name was?
Oh, that would have been great. Oh, but would he have survived if he was on the Planet of the Apes?
Yeah, probably not, but...
Oh, okay, sorry. So, yeah, we had a quick look at the animated series. I showed you the first and last episodes. And so what was your first impression? You know, I should have been recording you as you were watching it, because these reaction videos now are really big on YouTube, but maybe relive for us. What was that, your experience? Like, are you okay? Is there any PTSD after the experience?
I remembered some of it actually from when I watched it in the first run back in the 70s, was the fact that, yes, it wasn't some village kind of thing, that you've actually got them in armored transport vehicles or personal carriers and stuff like that. You got these columns. Now, the animation was a la Spider-Man and Rocket Robin Hood and Hercules and those kinds of things, where it's very basic and you see these things sort of moving across the screen, and it's just not at a very high level, because high level, you know, when it comes to animation, is a lot of money and a lot of time, and it takes years to make, you know, those great films. But that was the first thing, was that it was a much more advanced ape culture than was in those series. I'd have to remember back. I haven't seen it in a while, and I'm not sure if I'm going to return to it. But there was a Mark Wahlberg, part of the Tim Burton,
right,
one, and I thought that had more of an ape culture that was a bit more advanced, I think.
Yeah, it was much more like the Pierre Boulle novel. Yeah,
absolutely. But that was my thoughts, was Race Bannon and how advanced they are were the two big takeaways for me.
Yeah, I think anytime animation is used to describe Return to the Planet of the Apes, it must be done with air quotes.
Yeah, there's also the woman astronaut and the fact that they're more women characters, I think, in the animated one versus
And it was a surprise when to see that Nova was on it, which I thought was a cool inclusion. Like, there were things about it that I liked. And here's the feeling, like, I'm not sure about this, but I've read a little bit about it, but there's not a lot written about this series because it's not so much a series when it only lasts whatever 13 episodes. But I have a feeling that the order for the series must have been like really tight before it had to be on in September. Because like, I'm not sure that they would have, 20th Century Fox would have dropped the animated series concurrently with the live action series. And so that ended in December, right? As we know, they did reruns, but I have a feeling they probably like put out the order for the animated series, like probably was 6 months. And I don't know what the regular turnaround time is for that type of thing, but I know animation takes a hell of a long time. And so I think that's why it's so unanimated. I think basically they went with these background shots and these still faces and whatnot. They got scripts together and they went with it. But I think given their druthers, and TV's always done under the gun, but I think, you know, they would have probably liked maybe 6 months to a year longer to work on it, to actually develop it properly. But again, that's my speculation, but I can't even imagine why you would want to go even at that point in time. Like, even when things like there was a lot of Filmation stuff out there that, you know, they were shorter episodes. Like when you saw some of those, I'm thinking back to like Superman cartoons as a kid, they would be two or three of them within a half an hour. So that would allow you to have multiple people working on different storylines.
Right.
And again, they might have broken up these things too. But anyway, it just felt like, yeah, they were probably under a hell of a lot of pressure. Yeah. You know, it's the only Planet of the Apes product that I've never actually liked. Like, as a kid, I found it really disappointing. Oh, do you remember? Oh my God, David, see, I do have a little PTSD with it. That opening 10 minutes is so brutal. For people who have not seen it, and I don't know I want to recommend that you do watch it. It is on YouTube.
You
can find it. But the opening 10 minutes when the astronauts crash, it's like they're trying to replicate the opening of the Planet of the Apes scene where Heston and the other guys are there and they trek across the desert and you're not sure where they are. And for the first 20 minutes, it's a survival film. It has nothing to do with the apes. You don't get to see them till about the 40 minute or 30 minute mark. And that's the way it almost plays out in this cartoon for children on Saturday morning.
Yes.
Where it's like, oh my God, they're still walking. And unlike the Taylor scene with his other two companions where they're sniping back and forth, these people are saying nothing. It's like like no dialogue. It's like you're watching a European art film. You know? And I remember as a kid going, what is happening? And as
well, the answer to that is nothing is happening. They're walking. Like, you get a full sense of what it would feel like to walk across a desert like that, because you're watching it in real time. It's almost like the series 24 with Kiefer Sutherland. You almost see real events happen in real time. And then you have the whole line about this is the worst 24 hours of my life, or whatever his saying is. I've been rewatching the series, so I should have it memorized by now. But it's almost like 24 across Planet of the Apes. But you're right. It was just, and having that animation, which is not great, having to rewatch instead of, because if it was amazing animation, we get all these different senses.
Sure.
And go through some, but the, you know, is that the same rock that just passed by 2 minutes ago?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, even in, one of the best animated films ever is Fantasia. And the slowest segment in Fantasia is the Rite of Spring. And in that, you're seeing the Earth, you're seeing like the evolution of the Earth. And it can be, there are moments of that that are quite slow. And this is like that, but not good. You know, this is not Disney artists.
No.
Anyway, it's just so hard on the eyes. And I think you said it could be used at Gitmo as a means of getting information from prisoners.
Which yeah, I thought, that's how painful it is.
Yeah. Okay, we talked about the opening trek across the desert. We'll put that to rest. But again, I dare you, listeners. I don't encourage you to watch it, but it is on YouTube, so you can watch that opening segment. I just don't know how they expected to keep a viewing audience of children who are amped up on Fruit Loops and Lucky Charms from flipping the channel when the show that you're giving them feels like a closed circuit video feed of a Jesuit silent retreat. You know, I mean, it's deadly. And yes, I said it makes Super Friends look like Fantasia. And Super Friends could be really rough animation sometimes. Mm. All righty. But, you know, if you're a poetic completist, you might need to have a look at Return to the Planet of the Apes. And I don't think we've mentioned yet that the animated series employed actor Ted Knight to do narration for the show. All right, David, we're getting towards the end of our show, and I thought we should talk about, as we sometimes do, how it all ends. Part of me would definitely like to see the astronauts return home. And I'm talking about the live action network. We're going back. Right. We know that according to those bumpers recorded by Galen, that Verdon and Burke do make it home. So I would go with that in some form. And as I mentioned earlier, I think it might even be cool if they don't try to like come up with a way to restore a destroyed spaceship, but maybe they somehow go through a portal like in Star Trek with City on the Edge of Forever, something like that. They come across that instead. Again, the live action has no Nova. I would fix that. That would be like my first fix is like, you need a Nova type. Okay, I'm being flippant here, but I say that because The Exorcist was still a hot property, maybe I'd create a demonic possession story where either an ape or a human is possessed and know-it-all Verdon decides to do an exorcism, which I could just imagine him going like, you know, oh, I'm familiar with the ancient Roman ritual of the Catholic Church, and I think I could actually exorcise this demon, something like that. And like in The Exorcist, the demon leaves the victim and enters Verdon, and then Verdon kills himself, and Burke and Nova and Galen go about their happy ways, walking off into the sunset, and Burke says, I can get to like it here. Apes aren't so bad. That's what I do, Dave. How about you? Got any thoughts on how you'd like to wrap it up?
Yeah, you do hope that Verdon is able to do something, like is able to devise a way of them being able to get back home. That's the quest. They're trying to make it back home, but they're helping people along the way to further their ends. So if they make it home, that's great. I think Galen may eventually be, he's been on the run himself. So it's sort of hard for, how is he after those astronauts are able to leave? How is he going to be able to continue on in this? Unless there's some revolution, there's something that they're able to upset the balance or how things are. Cause I would like to see him in charge, but of course, if he is then in charge, he may be also in the position where he realizes that he's got to somehow keep humans from learning about what humanity was.
Ooh, I like that.
At one point, whether or not, yeah, he gets it on the other foot, the shoes on the other foot, so to speak, or however that saying is. You almost think that it would be, it would take a while, but there could be even a revolution or some way of the humans trying to get together and oust the apes or build their own place where they can survive. It's hard to say what might happen with some of the other characters, with General Urko, that whole, you know, the, you almost think that he would get to his comeuppance, just like in the movies, where, you know, ape does not kill ape. And there was that scene where I think one of the generals ended up killing someone, and they realized it killed an ape, and they and he's put down. And
oh, and you know what? That happens in the animated series. Urko is demoted and some other general takes over.
Oh, I didn't realize.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's sort of my future for them, is that they would somehow get home, and hopefully it's not one of those weird endings, you know, where, you know, sort of like in Sliders, where maybe the Golden Gate Bridge is a different color, or a gate doesn't squeak, right, or whatever. You're actually back to your reality versus all these alternative versions of, or you can create your own reality, just like in Back to the Future, where suddenly your father is now a best-selling author and you're living in a much better house, and the idiot that was bothering him is washing the car. You know, yeah, that kind of thing where it feels good.
I'm not actually pitching this as my idea, but I think it would be great if you could introduce a zombie outbreak onto the Planet of the Apes, because I don't know that it's been done. Like, I don't keep up on everything, especially within the comics, but I think that would be a really cool crossover if you had, like, you know, the undead of the Planet of the Apes or something like that. So you could, because it gives you the opportunity to have the ape makeup, but, you know, including zombie, like deteriorating, rotting apes.
Well, that's like an elevator pitch. You just say The Last of Us and Planet of the Apes.
Yeah.
And then they suddenly greenlight you to be able to create the series based on an ape world that actually has a zombie outbreak. So that would work.
Yeah, and I don't know if you've seen this, but recently I've seen a trailer for a film called Better Man, and apparently it's like a singing ape, like a Planet of the Apes ape on stage doing music, and Robbie Williams is somehow a part of this. Anyway, maybe that was a fever dream I had. I don't know.
I saw a commercial for that film. I have to figure out whether or not I actually want to see it or not.
Yeah.
It all depends on how, you know, because audiences nowadays, you do really have to bring the quality, because people, word of mouth, and just how, you know, when you talk about some great shows and great episodes, the bar is raised so high that it's very hard to put out a bad or mediocre series like what we've had to put up with for so long, until you have something like Hill Street Blues that knocks it out of the park, or some of these other series over the years. Things are at such a high level now that it's very hard to try to pass, you know, get people to accept something that isn't.
And it's hard to know if this movie Better Man is sort of like this year's Cocaine Bear or not.
Yeah, and I always wanted them to do like a crossover between Cocaine Bear and the Dungeons and Dragons movie. So you'd have Cocaine Owl Bear.
Or they could have had like BJ and the Bear, but it's BJ and Cocaine Bear.
Oh my God, BJ and the Bear reference. Now, but where is the Beatle-ism?
Oh, where God. Still. Yeah, no, it's funny. I have dropped the ball on this one, but here this is the stretch. I will give you 1968, the Beatles released the White Album, same year that Planet of the Apes was released, and John Lennon gives us the song "Everybody's Got Something to Hide Except for Me and My Monkey."
Oh, very good.
There you go. That's the closest I have for you.
Yeah, and I think early in the episode I almost said, "Oh, we got our Beatlesism out of the way right away," because I think you either hummed or had a very quick reference within the first 30 seconds of the episode that almost felt like a Beatlesism. I'd have to go back and re-listen to that early part, but I was almost going to comment right away and say, "Well, we got our Beatlesism out of the way."
Yeah, you know what? I will mention here to folks too, if you're like me and you like the sort of Beatlesisms, a friend gave me over the holidays a book called Love and Let Die. And it is like, it's nothing but Beatlesisms to James Bond. It's the comparison of all things Beatles to all things James Bond. And it's a fascinating read. And it's sort of like the idea behind it is it's an exploration or an examination of the British psyche during the 1960s and 1970s, and how he goes through various topics, various things that both the Beatles and Bond share. And man, it's a good read.
Love and Let Die, Bond, the Beatles, and the British Psyche is a book by John Higgs, H-I-G-G-S.
There we go. That is it. That's our POTA TV episode. And I am sad to have that in our rearview mirror. I've been looking forward to it for a while. If you're a fan of anything Planet of the Apes, please check out the website Hunter's Planet of the Apes Archives. There are many cool articles and PDFs for fans to go ape over. Please visit our socials at our website, Two Old Farts, which is numeric2of.ca. You'll find the archive of all of our episodes. On Facebook, you can interact with us and other listeners. On Facebook, we're just Two Old Farts Talk Sci-Fi. There's a lot to do there. Please let us know what you think. Please like and subscribe, and we'd really appreciate that. We hope you're enjoying our all-TV season. Remember, every rerun is somebody's first-time view.
I'm David Klink.
And I'm Troy Harkin.
And this has been Two Old Farts
Talk Sci-Fi.
No objection. I think we should go that way.
Does it matter? Everywhere we go, there's apes. Yeah. Some good, some bad. Come on.